This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So we're once again talking about those Twitter and Facebook accounts with no profile picture, no followers, and really weird posts. Guess what? So they can try to convince you of otherwise, but they're still just bots. And this surge of new anonymous Twitter accounts right across the region has deepened fears that the region is in the throes of almost what we saw in the American elections in 2016 when it came to mass social media manipulation.
Okay, so help me understand this. We're talking about, you know, this surge in new anonymous Twitter accounts. What exactly are they doing?
Well, what it does is, for example, if it is utilized by a person with malicious intent, it can, for example, take on a particular hashtag or hijack it and create negative connotations to it, negative content to it.
Right. Okay.
So, and then it creates a sort of an influence on what you're seeing on your timeline.
Right. Sort of giving someone tunnel vision the way we saw with Trump and the kind of press you would see on your timeline.
Absolutely. Right. And so with regards to this, there's, everyone might experiences in different ways. Some people might see a surge of 5 to 50 new followers. Some are seeing 1,000 new followers for no apparent or particular reason.
Right. Did you suddenly have an uptake in your following?
Well, I've been observing it. And when you do look into it, you can see that there it seems like an account that is not run by a person. It seems that it's been sort of created to identify particular type of personalities or influences.
Or to troll, perhaps.
Yeah, that's absolutely it.
So the concern here, I guess, is in the run-up to the general election and what that would do to the information that's out there, right?
Yeah. And because what we saw was that prominent Twitter users in Thailand, Vietnam, Myanmar, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Sri Lanka were noticing the same phenomenon. Mm. A surge in followers from anonymous, recently created accounts, adopting local-sounding names, wow, but barely engaging on the platform, as if waiting for
someone to tell them
what to do. Some sort of command. Yeah.
Well, it sounds very much like my Twitter account. I don't do much with, but yeah. It's very clever. So local sounding names, so that what they blend in.
Yes, absolutely. It. And then so you create content to it. You create hashtags. You follow. You attach certain hashtags to it to take the conversation another way or influence it in some shape, way, or form.
But are they created by?
Well,
by what are they?
Well, they could be created by any particular individual,
right.
More organized
systems, perhaps.
Yeah. And of course, we're seeing this more because even in the Philippines, in their 2016 presidential election, there was a surge of these organized bots and trolls deployed to support the man who eventually won it. In that case, it was populist Rodrigo Duterte. So
yeah, talking about it in our very layman's perspective, as much as we can understand. So we're now crossing over to Raymond Serrato, digital researcher and social media analyst with Democracy Reporting International. Thank you very much for joining us on the program, Ray. So yesterday you spoke with Uma and Ezra about how Twitter bots are employed in our upcoming elections, right? So a study found that the number of Twitter bots increased and they've been pushing out pro-government and anti-opposition tweets from what we're seeing. So Malaysia isn't alone in this. The bot problem has become a wider issue in Southeast Asia. Tell us what's happening.
So there are a few theories right now about the surge in bots popping up in Southeast Asia. I think there's a lot of speculation that they could be, state actors. I think, in my view, perhaps the most likely explanation is that there are IP addresses which have been compromised in these countries, and someone is using them to register new fake accounts on Twitter, likely to resell the accounts at a later day. So merchants or people who sell bots, they rely on having kind of unique IP addresses to avoid being blacklisted by Twitter. So I think that's the most likely explanation right now, especially because you see that many of the accounts are seemingly following automatically other influential accounts in the region, usually in the country. And this usually happens when a new account is registered based on its location, which is also based on its IP address. So I think for me, now that's the strongest theory.
Hmm. Right. And Raymond, is there really no risk of these bots being used for malicious reasons?
Well, for now, we haven't seen so much activity from these accounts, but I think the rapid appearance of them certainly heightened suspicion and fears about their purpose, right? Especially at a time when social media platforms are kind of being blamed for everything from inciting violence to meddling with like the media ecosystems. I think that's still a possibility, of course. We saw like recently in the Malaysian elections that those bots were specifically bought apparently in Russia, or at least in the Russian speaking world. But these other accounts, they don't have the same kind of features. They're more unique and tailored to each specific country.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they won't be used for those kind of purposes.
Right. And there's been evidence that bots on Facebook and Twitter have helped stir controversy and exacerbate certain conflicts within the region. Could you help perhaps elaborate on this point?
Sure. I think the most recent controversies are, you know, the role of social media and the outbreaks of violence in Sri Lanka and Kandy, and also the UN fact-finding mission's assessment that Facebook played what they say is a determining role in the crisis in Myanmar. And, you know, I think at least from my own research in Myanmar, I was able to, at least in Facebook, I was able recently to identify, you know, a Facebook group of Mawata, which is a nationalist organization. And there we saw that hate speech exploded online in this Facebook group around the same time that the crisis in Rakhine State started. And, you know, they had racked up within a number of 2 months around 2.5 million interactions, and they had shared content like almost 500,000 times. And one has to seriously ask themselves, you know, what was the impact of sharing these kind of posts, which were often inciting violence against Rohingya and Muslims at large, you know, on things that happen on the ground. And I think that's a similar kind of question that we are asking ourselves in Sri Lanka. You know, what was the role of Facebook in spreading rumors about Muslims in Kandy?
But can social media truly have that sort of impact? Or is there a chance we're perhaps exaggerating the power of social media?
You know, I think this is a really good question. And I think a lot of really simplistic approaches to it are they blame Facebook for the problems, or they blame Twitter for inciting, you know, this kind of hate speech. But we have to recall that at least, you know, in Myanmar, ethnic tensions have existed for more than like 3 decades. So it predates Facebook by many, many years. And it's a similar case in Sri Lanka. And I think in many countries, you know, which are post-conflict countries, these tensions predate social media. And we can't just point at social media alone as the main cause and effect. But I think what we can say is that the kind of speech that we see has never been disseminated with the same kind of speed and reach as it has, you know, previously. There's an interesting study in the context of Germany this year where political scientists showed that online hate speech against refugees predicted actual violence against refugees in municipalities where you had higher penetration of social media. I think that's an interesting finding that also should be replicated in other countries, specifically, you know, you have post-conflict countries where, you know, institutions aren't as robust and can't respond as quickly to something like fake news, right, which can quickly escalate, you know, if unsubstantiated, into violence. I think that's in any country, but I think in these countries particularly, sometimes institutions don't respond quickly enough.
Right. So some governments have plans to use social media platforms in their own way, right? Either to correct false information or to spread propaganda. Like Vietnam, they've pledged to build a cyber army to combat wrongful views.
Wrongful views.
Wrongful views, right. Apparently. So how do you feel about the usage of these platforms in this manner?
Yeah, I think we need to be really deeply skeptical about governments who want to begin building their own kind of cyber bullies. Or even those who want to monitor social media. I know in Myanmar, for example, the government recently set up a body to monitor social media, and quite an investment, I think almost $6 million. But the parameters of that body are really vague, and they could potentially infringe on freedom of expression. So right now, the body is supposed to look for uses of social media that disrupt harmony and corrupt the morals of youth. But in a context where dozens of journalists have been, you know, brought up on defamation charges for the things they have said in social media, I think we know we need to be kind of wary of what these monitoring bodies are actually looking for. You know, if they're only going to be used to go after the opposition or critics, or if, you know, they have their own cyber bullies who would do the same, I think the developments, you know, it's not going to be very good for the region.
Right.
So how should social media companies respond to all of these problems? Should they even respond?
I think one of the primary reasons that social media platforms should respond is they need to work more with kind of the citizen organizations that work in the countries. Because, you know, I think in many countries, the citizen groups are kind of, they've been critical to uncovering hate speech online and even averting violence. And we learned that a few weeks ago from some groups in Myanmar who wrote to Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, they understand the kind of political and social challenges of their countries best. I mean, that's also to say nothing of the local languages, right, where they can also monitor this in real time. So I think that's really the thing that Facebook needs to do the most of, and even Twitter, is to work kind of with citizen organizations to identify hate speech, because it's not very easy to monitor hate speech automatically, sometimes without causing collateral damage, because they might misidentify a word which, you know, in the context, or that isn't context specific and may not mean exactly what the machine learning algorithm thinks it means. And I think on the other side, I would say that they also have to be open with their data. So a lot of the research that's been done now on hate speech and fake news has relied on Facebook's, for example, their API, which is an application programming interface, to be open and to allow people to retrieve data that's anonymized, and to be able to use that to understand, you know, how is hate speech being used, who is spreading it, how are echo chambers being formed, you know, and what are the main vectors of misinformation.
Well, Ray, thank you very much for joining us on the Evening Edition and for your insights on this issue of the surge of Twitter bots that we're seeing in the region. That was Raymond Serrato, digital researcher and social media analyst with Democracy Reporting International. Here's some music.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.